I'm Angie Cuero. This is In Deep. This week, we are revisiting our very first show from January of this year. This hour, the efforts of the right and the fundamentalist Christians to undermine the teaching of accurate science in our schools. Mark McCaffrey of the National Center for Science Education and Dr. Barry Lynn of Americans United, coming up on In Deep. But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? 'Tis the dawn. No, it's not. My demented sidekick, Buttercup, it's got a laugh from the Political Carnival website and her own skewed view of the week's news. You're bringing us a passel-o-mit, young lady.
Passel-o-mit, I certainly am. He inspired me to open my own 7-Eleven bakery, and it took really long, but I actually came up with a new cookie design, a dog taking a bite out of Mitt Romney's aspirations.
I'm sure it's very attractive with little whiskers, and he's leaning down from above from the top of a car, of course.
Indeed, he is, and there's even some brown icing on top of the cookies to represent Seamus and his little escapade.
I may never eat a cookie again. Thank you for that.
It paints quite a picture.
But bring our listeners abreast, of course. Mitt and cookies were in the news together this week in yet another awkward Mitt pretending to be a human being moment.
Yes, good old awkward Mitski. He was having a picnic with some real live people, unlike himself, and he started talking cookies, and there were cookies on the table along with some other props.
Let's get a listen to his situation here.
Yeah, let's do that.
Mr. Mitt.
I'm not sure about these cookies. They don't look like you made them. Did you make those cookies? You didn't, did you? No. They came from the local 7-Eleven bakery or wherever.
When I heard it.
Oh, my goodness. They came from the local 7-Eleven bakery or whatever. That is a high compliment to the person who slaved over the cookies.
It was a local business that does, fresh-made cookies. And so they decided to exploit this and offer a CookieGate special, and they had some kind of a discount deal. So they took this Romneyism, and they used it to up their cookie sales. So he somehow inadvertently helped a small business grow and didn't fire any cookies in the process.
It's practically the anti-Romney campaign. You know, what amazes me, I mean, if you didn't know who this man was and you just saw his efforts to relate to normal humans, you might think he just fell off another planet. He's a humanoid. He's not a human.
There's nothing about him to me that's appealing, except maybe when he gets tan, he has nice skin. That's about it. He has no ingratiating qualities whatsoever.
Although he does keep trying. He wants people to understand that he has learned his lesson about putting the dog on the roof, but he's learned a different lesson than we meant him to learn.
Well, he should have learned another lesson. There was another story about a dog that's really disgusting. He has a buddy who's going to be throwing a birthday party, or did throw a birthday party for Ann Romney. And this guy is Frederick Malick III, who used to work for Nixon. He worked for John McCain during his candidacy, and he worked for Bush 41. Well, back in 1959, he was arrested with a couple of his friends for killing and barbecuing a dog.
Dear God.
No, seriously. They all got really drunk, and his friends apparently skinned the dog, gutted him, stuck him on a barbecue spit. This is in Peoria, in Illinois, and they got arrested for that. And, it's just this who you palling around with kind of thing. You know, this guy, he also had a run-in with, I've forgotten now. I can't remember. He had another legal run-in much more recently in 2004. And for Nixon, as the site Jezebel said, Malick would later go on to serve as one of Nixon's juice spotters after our paranoid nut of a 37th president determined that the Bureau of Labor Statistics had been overrun with the chosen people.
Oh, good Lord. Okay, who's not doing their job on the Romney campaign? Because, the dog barbecuing might be enough, but the Jew watching, you'd think between the two he might think he could get somebody else to work his party.
And yeah, that's the thing. The guy throwing a party is a fundraiser, so all the guests are invited to spend more money on the campaign. Here's your gift of $10,000. Forget Anne, you know. It's the whole thing just reeks. I mean, just there's nothing good about this.
Yikes. Well, you know, and of course we have to return to Seamus on the top of the car. And the other side says that we're beating a drum about something that happened years ago. But the fact is, he doesn't get why that's a problem. He still doesn't understand why it's an issue to stick your dog on top of the car at 60-some miles an hour for hours on end.
No, and his answer to that when he's been confronted is, well, we'd never do it again, quote, after the attention it received. So what about the abuse the dog received? What about that? And Anne is saying, well, the dog loved it. Well, you know, it all boils down to Romney's, well, he's running for office for Pete's sake. He's never going to do that again, at least until after he loses. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Now, I have to give you the same scolding I give everyone else who says he's going to lose. It's all about voter turnout, and it's all about watching voter suppression.
Oh, so I've been saying that. That's my mantra. It's voter suppression, voter turnout, super PAC money, and hatred of Obama. So you've got a bunch of things that we have to confront. And no, I do not. I am not at all complacent. I am the person beating the drum on Twitter saying don't be complacent.
Good job. And you know what? If you can't get people to go vote on any other basis, do it for Seamus.
Absolutely.
I thank you kindly for joining us as ever, delightful Sidekick Buttercup. And I take it we'll see you at this same bat time, same bat channel next week.
You got it.
Very good. Thank you for that. Gotta Laugh joins us every week for her own skew on the news. You can follow her every day at thepoliticalcarnival.net. You're listening to In Deep. This week, we are bringing you a rebroadcast of our very first show. Enjoy. Welcome to In Deep with Angie Carro. Very pleased to have you with us this hour. We're happy to be talking to the East Coast from Berkeley, California. And as usual, our conversation for the hour is sparked off by something in the news. This time, climate change. I know a lot of stories about that always, but this is particularly interesting for those who are worried about the next generation of thinkers. There are states that have introduced education standards that require teachers to defend the denial of man-made global warming. I'm taking this right out of an article from the LA Times, and there's a national watchdog group that says it is going to start monitoring classrooms and watching for this. Let me give just a taste of this article from the Los Angeles Times. A flashpoint has emerged in American science education that echoes the battle over evolution. As scientists and educators report mounting resistance to the study of man-made climate change in middle and high schools. Although scientific evidence increasingly shows that fossil fuel consumption has caused the climate to change rapidly, the issue has grown so politicized that skepticism of the broad scientific consensus has seeped into the classrooms. That's our topic for this hour. We'll be talking later with the Reverend Barry Lynn. You've heard him on my shows before. He's, of course, with the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. He's going to give us a little bit of the evolutionist playbook to tell us what we might anticipate from the climate change deniers as they try to move into the school boards and into the school rooms. If you are with the majority of scientists who understand that climate change is underway and there is a man-made element, and yet you don't find you can always talk about that intelligently in a group, we're going to help you out with that. We'll touch on some of the issues there where you may not be clear on why there is a scientific consensus around that. The National Center for Science Education is the aforementioned group from the Los Angeles Times article. Their title is Defending the Teaching of Evolution and Climate Science. And from that group, we have Mark McCaffrey here in the studio. He's their programs and policy director. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Angie.
It's very good to have you here. You and I were talking a little bit before we started recording about the whole issue of climate science. And as you were telling me, and I didn't realize, dates as far back as Darwin.
That's correct, Angie. The history of climate science goes back to the early 1800s. And it is very parallel in many, many respects to the research that was going on that Darwin picked up on in the mid-1800s. And there was a fellow named John Tyndall, who's a British scientist, a contemporary of Darwin, who was very fascinated by the Earth's energy balance. And so he started doing some laboratory experiments in the 1850s, because he was convinced that the Earth was a bit warmer than it should be naturally in terms of measuring the incoming energy from the sun and the outgoing energy from the Earth after it's been warmed by the sun. And so he did some of the original laboratory work in the Royal Institution in London back in the 1850s, and he published about that in the 1870s. And that kind of set the stage for modern-day climate science.
Well, Darwinism and the study of evolution, as soon as it hit the headlines, made a big splash and was immediately part of the social and political dialogue. When did that become true of climate change?
Tyndall was actually a very popular speaker. He went on the road and he talked about a lot of his different research. He was also fascinated by glaciers. He tramped around in the Alps quite a bit. He was a very dynamic speaker from everything I've heard. And so he started to talk about the basic dynamics of climate back in those days. But it wasn't until a generation later when a Swedish scientist, Svante Arrhenius, a giant in the chemistry world, he kind of helped define the term pH. But he started calculating the potential impact of burning coal and how that could release what he called carbonic acid. We now call that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And he knew from the work of John Tyndall that that could trap some of that outgoing heat from the Earth after it had been warmed by the sun. So he calculated that over time, the Earth could be warmed by that additional carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And of course, almost immediately there was pushback from other scientists or people outside of science that were upset by his theory, so-called, at the time. And it's taken us the better part of 100 years after him to build the observation base and dive into the theory in more detail. I will point out that 50 years ago, in the late 1950s, during the International Geophysical Year, the National Academy of Sciences here in the United States published a little booklet where they talked about the potential for the warming of the Earth, the melting of ice caps, and the raising of sea level because of the increased levels of carbon dioxide. So even in science education materials back in the 1950s, that was a concept that was being widely accepted by the science community and even in some educational circles.
Well, that gives us a thumbnail history of climate study and climate controversy. Let's get a thumbnail history of the National Center for Science Education. Where did it sprout from? How long has it been around? And then tie it into this story for me about what's happening in the classroom now.
Okay. NCSE, as we call it for short, has been around since the 1980s, and they're quite a legend in the science education field for the work they've done over these past couple decades to defend the teaching of evolution in schools. They've been on the front lines in many situations that in some cases have led to court cases, and the science education community, particularly the biology community, is, I think, very grateful for the work that NCSE has done over the years. The past several years, members of NCSE, because it's a membership-driven organization, have been telling the executive director at NCSE, Jeannie Scott, that NCSE ought to be also defending the teaching of climate change, because there's been pushback in certain communities. Teachers have been reporting that students get up and walk out of class whenever the topic of climate change / global warming comes up. In some cases, school boards have been petitioned, or people on the school board who have a certain leaning, political leaning perhaps, try to water down the teaching of climate change or discourage it. There's still a lot of unknowns about how serious this problem is because so much of the information is anecdotal. But I think one of the things that we're geared for is to be able to help people whenever there's a flare-up like that and be able to track it, be able to give people the guidance and tools to be able to really fight back to make sure that we have strong climate change education in this country.
You're listening to In Deep with Angie Carter. My guest is Mark McCaffrey. He's Programs and Policy Director for the NCSE, and we're talking about the linkage between the fighting back against teaching of climate change in the school, just as we've seen the fighting over evolution for so many years. I'm trying to wrap my mind around the idea of a kid getting up and leaving a classroom when this is taught. I guess I hadn't realized that in some families and in some classrooms, it's reached that level of a fever pitch. It takes a lot to get a kid to walk out of a classroom.
Absolutely, and similar to evolution, it's ideologically driven, but in the case of evolution, the ideology is generally religious, And certainly in the case of climate change, it tends to be much more politically driven, and often from people who are very much into kind of a libertarian point of view. But even then, I don't want to label this too much as a particular flavor, because I think those who are denying climate change, either literally or they interpret it by saying, well, maybe it's warming, but it's just natural cycles, it's hard to lump them all into one group. I think we know that for some reason or another, the very idea of climate change touches a nerve or pushes a button in them, and they can react very emotionally.
You know, I'm glad you reminded me, because I wanted to put out there, the NCSE is not an ideological group. You're not affiliated with Democrats. You're not affiliated with Republicans.
Right.
You're an institution of science.
Absolutely.
And that's your primary goal, is to get the science out there.
Right. The only thing we really advocate is solid, robust science education. We take no partisan viewpoint, and we certainly do promote best teaching practices around climate change. Climate change, as I said, can be a very emotional topic, and there's a certain gloom and doom aspect to it that teachers aren't always very well prepared to deal with. It can be alarming, and so we've had cases where teachers have done like a three-week unit on climate change, and the parents are upset because the kids have nightmares or are very depressed about the future. And so the teachers have, on their own initiative, found that it's really important to integrate solutions in at every step of the way. Now, that can be challenging in a science class, but it's important the young people not feel completely overwhelmed or powerless to deal with this crisis that's already happening but is going to become even more serious over the coming decades.
So the teachers who are charged in the classroom with clearing up the story, with teaching it, do you see the lesson plans that they have? Do you know what's being taught, and do you have input into it that's being accepted?
Well, as you know, this country's education system is a real hodgepodge. We have no national curriculum. Every state has their own science standards. Often districts have their own science standards that may or may not agree with state standards. And it hasn't been until very recently that climate change education has been a priority. In 2009, shortly after we completed the development of the essential principles of climate literacy, climate change education became a presidential priority, and funding started to go into development of good curriculum. A lot of this is brand new because there wasn't much good curriculum, certainly not during the 2000s, and even there was a start of some decent curriculum in the 1990s, and then all the funding for that dried up from, say, 2000 to 2009. So a lot of this good education material is just being developed. Teachers are so hungry for high-quality resources. There's one website that, in full disclosure, I was very involved with called CLEAN, the Climate Literacy Energy Awareness Network, CLEANET.org. I'll put in a little pitch there for it.
And we'll link that on our website.
But it's funded by the National Science Foundation, and it's essentially like a digital library of high-quality, well-reviewed and annotated resources that teachers can use.
Now, surely you're going to run into some teachers and some school administrators who are denialists. How do you deal with that?
Well, we have yet to see exactly how bad the situation is, because so much of the work that's been done so far to survey teachers and get their feedback, that's been through stories, anecdotes, second and third hand information. So one thing that we're going to be pushing for very strongly is the idea of a national survey among middle, high school and also undergraduate teachers of science throughout the country to get a sense of where the holes are, where climate change is being taught, are they getting good support, and are they experiencing this type of feedback or pushback, rather, that we've had enough evidence that it's happening to be concerned about.
Mark McCaffrey is going to be back with me in the next segment. He's with the National Center for Science Education, which is taking on the task of monitoring what's happening with those lessons in the schools with hope of keeping the science teaching relatively pure. We're going to come back with more of this on In Deep with Angie Clare. We're back in a moment.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention? We're
This is a rebroadcast of an earlier In Deep show. And you're listening to In Deep. Welcome back. I'm Angie Cora. We're talking this hour. It's a conversation provoked by an article in the Los Angeles Times, and that covers the new influence of people who are looking into the teaching of climate science in the classroom. They are against the idea that there's a consensus that global warming is real and that it is influenced by real human beings. And there's concern that they are starting to tilt the science that is being taught in the schools. My guest is from the National Center for Science Education. It's also known as the NCSE. And their primary concern is the pure teaching of science. And we're talking about how well that might be achieved. My guest is Mark McCaffrey, Programs and Policy Director with the group. We were talking a little bit about how there may not be consensus among all scientists, but among the scientists who study climatology, among the people who actually study the issue of global warming, yes, it is a given that this is happening. Well, the Los Angeles Times article talks about the NCSE's efforts to monitor this, and I hear that you're getting feedback from teachers and you're trying to cast a wide net with that. What are the other methods you're going to use to actually monitor what happens in the classroom? Because, of course, they're not obligated to tell you.
I think one of the strengths of NCSE, and certainly one of the things that attracted me to come and work with this program, is the fact that they have this incredible network of supporters around the country who are really on the front lines of defending high-quality science education. And so we'll be relying on them to help us often work behind the scenes. You know, we in some instances, will work in more of a public arena, but I think historically NCSE has been most successful, except in very high-profile cases, you know, working kind of under the radar, working one-on-one with teachers and people who are wrestling with a school board. If people do experience problems, whether they're teachers or concerned parents who want to make sure that their young people are really prepared to make good choices in the future by having a solid understanding of the science, then they can get in touch with us should they have any problems, and hopefully we'll be able to help them out.
And we are definitely going to put a link to your site on our site so people can find that as well. And our site, because our show is a production of Live from the Left Coast, you can find all of our links and all of our show information at lftlc.com. That's Live from the Left Coast, lftlc.com. You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Carter. Mark McCaffrey is in the studio here with me. And Mark, one of the things I promised our listeners is that I'm going to arm them for those conversations that come up at dinner parties and at cocktail parties, and they hear the anti-climate change, the deniers talking, and they don't know how to answer them.
Right.
So I'm going to give you some of the arguments, and you let me know how we confront something like this. There's not enough of a track record. We don't have enough science stretching back over enough years to prove that this is really an aberration, that this is something to be concerned about.
And they probably don't understand the fact that as I mentioned earlier, climate science is over 150 years old. It's built on the peer review process, and it is actually very robust. The military actually in the 1940s did a lot of research about carbon dioxide because it was affecting their missiles, and that's just a part of this very solid basis of climate science.
But isn't 150 years a blip in the life of the Earth, in the life of the climate?
Well, not in terms of scientific knowledge. In terms of deep time, and even human history, it's a very short time, but look at how much the world has changed in 150 years. You know, the population of the Earth has gone from less than 2 billion people to over 7 billion people, and we've gone from using a tiny amount of fossil fuels to a gargantuan amount of fossil fuels. We move enormous amounts of matter, not just burning carbon dioxide and moving dirt around, but we have enormous impact on other parts of the Earth system, the nitrogen cycle, the phosphorus cycle, and so forth. The one thing I'd like to stress here is that we have to pick our battles when we get into these type of debates with people who are often trained in how to try to derail somebody who takes climate change seriously. We have to pick our battles because some people are just not going to listen to reason.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think before anybody goes into a situation like that where they feel like they have to defend the climate science, you need to have a little bit of an appreciation for who are you talking to. Is it somebody who actually is skeptical in the best sense of the word? Or is it somebody who's so dogmatic and rigid in their ideology that no matter what you say, they're not going to listen to you?
You're better off going to get another canapé than having a conversation with this person. So let's say we're talking to a well-intended but uneducated person who says, look, we've got a new record set this morning in San Rafael. It was, 13 degrees? We've got snow up in Seattle when it's normally just rain up there. How can you say the Earth is warming?
Well, that's sometimes why the term climate change is more accurate, because we look at last year, 2011, and there were some record low temperatures set, record snow set in some areas, but there were also twice as many record heat records set last year as record colds. Climate is sometimes defined as averaged weather, yet we have to look at it at all the climate records in aggregate, because one of our colleagues, Hunter Lovins, describes it as global weirding rather than global warming, because there's just the human beings have become a force of nature, and the way we're tweaking the Earth's environmental systems by the sheer fact of our numbers and our consumption of fossil fuels in particular is having quite a ripple effect that doesn't necessarily immediately translate into warming.
Global weirding has legs.
I
think that really goes to the point, because we are talking about, in some cases, absolutely freak weather in our own experience.
Right, right. And the American public recognize that. We have had some extremely unusual weather in the past year, and yes, we can't necessarily attribute all that weird weather to climate change, because weird weather happens, whether human beings are around or not. I think that the vast majority of Americans actually think climate change is happening. They are confused about the scientific consensus. And so one thing that we're eager to do is to make it clear that climate scientists do agree that it's happening and agree that humans have a large role in this. The thing that we're stressing foremostly is that we owe it to our children to have the tools, have the knowledge, have the wherewithal to be able to make informed decisions as they go on to become leaders and business people and potentially scientists in the future.
Well, since you seem open to a lot of good questions, I'm going to bring you deep into my personal life on this one. And we're going to have Gordon lock the studio door, because he's probably going to want to leave after this. But I actually had this conversation with my boyfriend, who is an intelligent, well-informed person, and yet, this one I had to throw at you, I was talking to him about what I discussed with you earlier about how a lot of the people who deny climate science as we know it to exist are funded by entities that profit from the climate not doing well. His response to me was, all of these scientists who are in research, who are in universities, are grant-reliant, and there is a government edict or a government move to push the narrative of climate science, and if you want to keep your grants, and if you want to keep your research lab running and have your interns, you'd better fall in line with the climate change / global warming theories. Now, I grant this, you'll have to take it on my word. This is a man with a good heart and a good mind, but he believed that. Now, tell me how to answer that.
Ah, boy, that's a tough one. I'm not sure what the short answer is, because there is a lot of government grant money that is going to dry up, frankly, because there was more money during the George W. Bush years put into climate research in the United States than all other countries of the world combined. And even George W. Bush in early 2001 admitted that climate change is happening. Humans have an important role in that, but his response is that we don't know enough, so we need to do more research. And so I don't want to blame him in this case for all the research dollars that have gone into climate research, But as far as I'm concerned, that's money that's been well spent, because we really need to get a better handle on what's happening and what's likely to happen. A lot of these type of debates or questions, in my mind, distract us from the question of what are we going to do about it? Let's accept the fact that it's happening, and let's even accept the fact that human beings are, if not largely responsible, at least we have some role in what's happening. And therefore, we have a responsibility to prepare for it and certainly prepare our young people for changes that are already well underway, whether it's in polar regions with polar bears or in our own backyard with sea level rise in the East Bay or in Manhattan Island. An interesting thing that I've noticed is that where people are actually preparing for climate change is on the local level. A lot of things are happening at the city and regional level. So, for instance, here in the Bay Area, there's plans underway for what to do about sea level rise, because it's going to impact our airports. Both the Oakland Airport and San Francisco Airport are basically at sea level. It's going to impact bridges and up in the Seattle area. You just mentioned the big storms they're having up there. The hydrologic cycle has been intensified, so getting more moisture in the atmosphere is going to lead to more precipitation, so we get more snow events, snow in the winter, more intense rain in the summer, and that's going to affect flash floods, and the bridges have to be prepared, storm surges and so forth, or something that Norfolk, Virginia, where there's a big naval base, the Navy takes this very, very seriously. And so, as I say, I think that all these type of questions, they may be well-intentioned and there may be a grain of truth to them, but it's a distraction from having an adult conversation about what we're going to do about it, which we as a country have just not done yet.
Well, and there's something refreshing in what you're just saying, and that is because there is so much conversation, to which I'm contributing, about whether this is real or not. It's reassuring to hear that the government entities, even on the local, smaller level, cities and counties,
right,
are moving forward with the preparation. We don't hear nearly as much,
right,
about the fact that they're already preparing as we do about is it or isn't it true.
Yeah. So what areas are going to get wetter, and including more intense floods and rainfall events? Dry areas are going to get drier, and we see that in Texas. Look at what happened in Texas this past year with unbelievable drought, unbelievable wildfires, and that's going to be increasingly the case. So in dry areas, they're starting to prepare for droughts and wildfires. Certainly not all droughts and all wildfires are necessarily caused by human beings, but we're just adding fuel to the fire, so to speak. I'm sorry about that pun there. But
that's all right. We're going to put that out nationally, too. So. I want to remind you that we're talking to Mark McCaffrey. He's here in the studio from the NCSE. This is the group that is keeping an eye on the science as it's being taught in the schools, and this article on the Los Angeles Times, which we'll link from our website, is what prompted the conversation. The NCSE is the National Center for Science Education, and it's based here in the East Bay, but it is, in fact, a national organization. Mark McCaffrey in the studio is the Programs and Policy Director. As we're winding or toward the end of the interview, I wanted to know if there's anything you feel that we haven't addressed this hour. We're going to be talking to Barry Lynn in just a moment to talk about getting a playbook to fighting this on the ground,
yeah,
fighting it in the school boards. But what else do we need to hear that we haven't hit on?
So there's a part of our website, and I would encourage everybody who's interested in this to go to ncse.com/climate. And we have a Climate 101 section that kind of reviews the basics of the science, a teaching section for teachers in particular, a taking action section for people who are interested in helping to ensure that climate science education is robust in this country. But we also have a section on denial, which, of course, is kind of a loaded word. And there's some very, very interesting sociology research on denial. And one fellow, Stanley Cohen, has been talking about three types of denial. Literal denial, where somebody will say, it's just not happening, it's untrue. Interpretive denial, which is saying, well, maybe it's happening, but it's solar cycles or cosmic rays or something like
kind
that.
Kind of the never mind position.
Yeah, and there's nothing we can do about it is sort of the next logical step from there. And then there's the sort of implicit denial where somebody will accept the science but then not do anything about it. And I think that's really the stage we're at as a country right now, that we, by and large, 70 to 80% of people take climate change pretty seriously. You know, it depends on what's happening in the economy and so forth, but it's very solid, actually. But meanwhile, and actually most people support clean energy, would even pay a little bit more for clean fuels and so forth. At least they say they will.
That's true, yeah.
Again, we haven't had this an adult conversation as a nation about really what to do. The ideological fringe has been able to hold the country hostage so that we can't have an adult conversation because it gets into a shouting match all too quickly, or it gets derailed into sort of a side discussion. And of course, as with the smoking issue, that was a tactic of just sowing seeds of doubt to procrastinate and keep any real decision from being made. But I think that thinking of denial and not calling somebody a denialist in a pejorative way or a negative way, but recognizing that there's enough denial for us all to own a piece of it, maybe is a step forward.
I think that's brilliant. And I want to pick up on one point you made there, and that is you were talking about the increasing belief or the acceptance of the reality of global warming. That is in opposition to what we're seeing with evolution, where there are fewer and fewer people who say, you know, flat out, yes, evolution has occurred. Yes, evolution is a reality. Are we seeing any loss in the numbers, or are we, because we lost numbers on the evolution battle, are we steadily upward in the climate change?
Well, you know, it is in flux, and there's a number of different surveys out there, and they give somewhat overlapping, but in some cases contradictory snapshots of where we stand. I think it's very clear that as a nation we're climate illiterate, we're energy illiterate. Most people have no clue where their energy really comes from, or the impact on the environment of their energy choices or consumption. And of course, energy and climate are very, very intricately linked. I think we really need a national campaign to explicitly increase our collective understanding of both climate and energy, because that would go a long way to helping to really take a step forward towards a solution rather than continually getting bogged down in these sideshows.
Sounds like a good job for the NCSE.
Well, okay. We'll take it under consideration.
Mark McCaffrey, thank you so much. It's been great.
It's been a pleasure.
Coming up next, we're going to talk to the Reverend Barry Lynn of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. We see some of the pages of the playbook from the evolution deniers as they move into the schools. And so we're going to see how we can battle scientific illiteracy in the schools by taking a look at how we respond to that same playbook. So stick around for that. You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro.
Well, Eve told Adam, snakes, I've had them. Let's get out of here. Go raise this family someplace out of town. They left the garden just in time with the landlord cussing right behind. They headed east and they finally settled down. One thing led to another. A bunch of sons, one killed his brother. And they kicked him out with nothing but his clothes. Human race survives, cause all those brothers found wives, but where they came from, they ain't nobody knows. Well, Charlie Darwin looked so far into the way things are, he caught a glimpse of God's unfolding plan. God said, I'll make some DNA, they can use it any way they want, from paramecium right up to man. They'll have sex and mix subsections of their code, they'll have mutations. The whole thing works like clockwork over time. I'll just sit back in the shade while everyone gets laid. That's what I call intelligent design. Yeah, you and your cat named Felix are both wrapped up in that double helix. It's what we call intelligent design.
This is In Deep. This show was originally recorded in January of this year. Welcome back to In Deep here on We Act Radio. I'm Angie Cuero. We're talking this hour about the movement to get scientifically accurate teachings on global warming in the classroom. And as we just established with my earlier guest, Mark McCaffrey, global warming deniers are trotting the same path in this battle as some of the very same groups and individuals have done with the fight over accurate teaching of evolution. They have been running for and winning school board seats. They've been painting the issue with the media with an appalling amount of success for years as having two legitimate sides. You have to teach, quote unquote, both sides of the issues. So we know how they work. And the upside of this being an old story by now is that we've seen a good chunk of their playbook, and it gives us a chance to fight back if we pay attention and if we use the past to inform the future. And with that, I would like to welcome back to our airwaves Dr. Barry Lynn. He's the executive director of the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. He's always so generous about making himself available. Barry Lynn, welcome back.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Let me ask you, first of all, you've been watching this developing controversy over climate science teachings in the school. I'm sure you've had flashbacks. I'm sure you thought, boy, howdy, this sure sounds familiar. So what are the key areas where you see the same kind of mentality and the same key steps emerging?
Well, one of the important things to remember, Ralph Reed, who, of course, used to be the head of the Christian Coalition and then, of course, fell into even worse company, arguably, and lobbied for some of the worst people out there. But he's now got a new Faith and Freedom Coalition that he's trotting out around the country. He once said that he would rather elect 10,000 school board members than the president of the United States. So he understood that at the level of school boards, where it's easier to get elected, it doesn't cost as much money. He knew that the influence over children and their parents would be greater if he could manipulate the curriculum in order to debunk evolution and promote ideas like creationism and intelligent design, pretty much the same thing. People need to go and take an active interest in who is running for the school board. They need to make sure that they have observers go to the school board meetings in their county or their city and just make sure that nobody starts bringing up stuff that might on the surface look harmless, like we're just going to give all sides to an issue. But in fact, what they're trying to do is ram junk science or non-science or even nonsense down the children's mouths at school.
And, of course, that's the next up-and-coming generation of voters. It's a very good thing to introduce doubt at this point in their educational lives.
Certainly is. And the other thing, of course, is to almost make a kind of classical liberal argument, which is to say, shouldn't all sides be aired? Of course, if you say something like, well, do you think we should teach that perhaps the Earth is the center of the universe or maybe it's the sun? And you think that would be so ridiculous. But a gentleman sent me a book about 300 pages long arguing against the heliocentric universe. In other words, arguing that the Earth was, in fact, sitting still, the sun was rotating around us. But to the extent that they can find anybody with a science degree, in fact, if they can find anybody with a lab coat that they once wore to a Halloween party, they will trot that person out and say, there's a difference of opinion on this matter. And certainly with evolution, there's no difference of opinion. There is, let's face it, some skepticism from real scientists and real skeptics about some of the edges, at least, of the debate over climate change and global warming. But the kind of so-called debunking that's done by the Glenn Becks of the world and the pseudoscientists of the world needs to be countered very directly. The fact that we don't know everything, we don't have a fossil record that includes every single fossil, we don't have every idea about why human interaction with the environment seems to cause global warming, it becomes the excuse for the deniers to say that there's any validity at all. Or in the contrary, they say, well, we don't know everything. There's a difference of opinion. Let's hear both sides. And then occasionally I even hear from progressives who say, even about evolution, well, you know, maybe they're right. No, they're not right. And the fact that you can find bits and pieces of evidence and construct a belief system is quite different from the scientific method, where you develop a hypothesis and then you try to test it. You don't just find one piece of data from geology, one piece of data from entomology, throw them all together and say, see, now we have an alternate theory.
One of the things that I think that the people who are opposed to the teaching of evolution, and I'm seeing this as well in the people with global warming arguments, they're playing the media like a fine-tuned Steinway. I mean, they know that the media in so many cases is overly concerned with being even-handed and overly concerned with not asserting a quote-unquote point of view, to the point that just getting the facts right is now seen as divisive in some arenas.
No, it certainly is. And this idea of equal treatment or equal time, the problem is that if one side constitutes 98% or 99% of the actual scientists on any subject and the other, quote, side is 1%, you do the public a disservice. You misrepresent the strength of the other argument. If you said, look, this person has this view, but we have to say we've looked through all the records, the journals, and we find that he's the only guy who has this idea, at least it would be honest. I know many scientists who will not debate the issue of creationism, for example, because they don't want to give any credit at all. I do tend to dispute that. I'm not a scientist. I do talk about the process of science. I do understand what the law is. Oh, people still come up to me and say, we saw you once on the Bill Buckley firing line special on evolution. And it was important, I thought, to make the points about why what the other side was saying, even the ones that had some kind of so-called scientific credential, were fundamentally wrong about their approach, and that they were illogical, unreasonable, and using religion, of course, as the cover for pseudoscientific ideas. And that we, too, see when it comes to the debate over global warming.
You're listening to In Deep with Angie Coiro, and my guest is Reverend Barry Lynn with the Americans United for Separation of Church and State. One of the things that I've often decried about the American education system is it doesn't really teach critical thinking. Now, having gone through law school, presumably you have been taught something along the lines of logical thinking about, you know, assessing facts and coming to a rational conclusion that is supported by the facts. That doesn't seem to be so much present, especially in the younger grades. It's something that kids can learn, you know, optionally when they get into the upper grades of high school or they move into college and they want to take a logic course, they can. Mm-hmm. But do we not have failures in our educational system that don't prepare children for arguments like evolution, like global warming?
Yeah, I think you've really hit the nail on the head. And what's even worse, not only do we not have critical thinking, but frequently if you describe what is about to be added to the curriculum as critical thinking, you will find the same people on the religious and secular right coming in and saying, wait a minute, we're against that. Now, why would you be against critical thinking? You'd be against critical thinking because if you have your child question anything in school, why, the next thing that's going to happen is they might question you, the parent, and then they might question the pastor of your church, and then they might start to question whether they should even be going to church. Anarchy prevails. So these folks, I mean, it's my kind of anarchy. I like it. It's called common sense and debate. And you also find that in a lot of the religious schools, debate is taught not like perhaps you would see, or perhaps you participated as a debater in, say, a high school. These kids are often taught just to throw out as many facts as possible, literally to count the number, because in certain kinds of scoring of debate nowadays, I find this absurd, the other side must respond to every point made. If you don't respond to the point, you lose the point. So if I said, you know, your name is Cassandra, you'd have to debate that. And then if I said 37 other things about you that are false, you'd have to manage some piece of evidence to debunk it, or you would lose those points. So this is the kind of style that occasionally, when on those rare occasions when I'm still invited back onto the Fox News channel and it's not 6 o'clock in the morning and they don't want me to discuss Veggie Tales, that really was the last time I was asked, Veggie Tales, a Christian cartoon, the other guy said that if you don't show your kids his cartoons, you let them watch normal TV, you're teaching them atheism. See,
oh, and I mean, you took issue with that.
Yeah, one of the problems, you know, in talking about any of this, the stuff that they say is so ludicrous that sometimes you just make a joke about it. People laugh appropriately, but they don't realize that those folks who aren't laughing do constitute 20 to 21% of the American electorate who self-define themselves as the religious right or conservative evangelicals or a phrase like that. They consider them badges of honor.
Exactly. And a much higher percentage of those are the people that you're going to find at the school board meetings, et cetera, because they have an agenda and they're set to pursue it. What does it gain the people who have been fighting the teaching of evolution to suddenly take on global warming as a cause?
I think it does remind them that we are, unfortunately, a scientifically illiterate country. We're also an economically illiterate country because the kind of radio, for example, that you do, this form of giving someone 20 minutes to talk about an issue, is so rare that there's almost no venue to have serious discussions at all. So we can't really blame the people because all they hear are conclusions. They hear, as you pointed out earlier, one guy is wearing a lab coat who says evolution is clearly occurring. Someone is saying humans are responsible in large measure for climate change. And then there's another guy, the same 7 seconds, who says the data has already been falsified and we know it's a fraud and don't worry about it because it's not going to happen. Weather goes in cycles. The polar bears will be fine. Now, how do you judge the integrity of those arguments if you don't have enough time to hear a person not just draw a conclusion, but to explain how she or he got to that conclusion?
And who he or she might be affiliated with, which of course is
always
a big issue here.
Well, that's important too. I mean, we have to be careful. I mean, there are advocacy groups who advocate ideas that they actually believe are true, and they should be up to the test of being challenged. But I'm more interested, personally at least, in seeing how people get from A to B, how they get from the so-called evidence, or maybe the real evidence, to B, the conclusion.
Dr. Barry Lynn is the executive director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State in Washington, D.C., and we're talking to him about the fight to keep the pure teaching of global warming and other legitimate science in the classroom. We're running so close to out of time already, and I want to make sure, Barry Lynn, that we go into detail as to the playbook, how to fight this. You mentioned getting people elected to school boards, paying attention at the school board meetings. What are the other ways to conquer this sort of wave to try to get this into the schools?
You know, parents, including parents with science backgrounds, have every right. I'd say they even have a responsibility. When their child comes back from a junior high school or a high school class and says something occurred in the classroom that seems odd, the religious right teaches children, even elementary school kids, how to engage their teachers. On evolution, for example, they're supposed to stand up and say, teacher Jones, were you there when the dinosaurs died? You know, like, well, if you weren't there, you must not have the facts. That's literally being taught in church schools to kids, that is like in a Sunday school, so that those questions in just that way can be raised in the public schools. It's up to responsible parents who think there's something a little fishy. They look at the science textbook and maybe they notice, as we did up in Dover, Pennsylvania, that there were supplemental readings that were being suggested or assigned. And those supplemental readings to the biology book in high school in Dover, Pennsylvania, happened to be intelligent design textbooks, which just happened to be contributed by the local church in bulk to that school library. You have to watch. As a parent, you have to watch. If you're a high school student, you can usually smell a rat. If you smell something fishy, bring it up and be able to talk to the teachers. I'm afraid that what will happen is that 1/3 of the teachers in earth sciences will now decide they're not going to teach about climate change, just as 1/3, believe it or not, of the biology teachers in this country do not teach evolution at all, or at most spend one session, one day on this centerpiece of modern science. They're afraid to go. I once spoke to a conference of the National Association of Biology Teachers at a huge room set up. There couldn't have been 30 people there. It was set up for hundreds. Afterwards, I could pretty much walk up to all 30 of them. I said, nobody's here. And they said, oh, well, we have people from our school. And they found out that what this topic is, they don't even want to be seen coming into a session on this topic. Now, that's scary. That's scary.
Yes. Yes, it is. One of the issues you and I have not touched on is the fact that some of the teachers, statistically we know some of the teachers will not be in favor of the accurate teaching of science, and even those who are may have school administrators above them who have their own agendas at work. How do we work to support the teachers who are trying to teach things purely?
Well, one of the things we've always noticed when these controversies come up is that if you get a local controversy, you get a lot of local attention. After the Dover case, we had a fuss out in California, in Southern California, where a teacher was planning to teach a course on basically on creationism. And so we said, well, this is just creationism. We don't care if it's just an optional class. It shouldn't be taught at all. This isn't legitimate. They're using books from phony organizations peddling pseudoscience. We eventually settled the case. She was forced to change the course to something else. But the newspaper one day in that local community ended up with 3 pages of letters to the editor back and forth. That's what we call getting the message out. And, of course, eventually the truth does prevail. And when you get people talking about an issue like this, it's often clear that the other side's so-called evidence doesn't hold up to scrutiny, that their understanding of science is so weak-kneed that it isn't even worthy of being called science. And you learn that through the debates that go on in the local community. So much as it is a pain, and an expensive pain, I should add, to go and litigate or threaten to litigate cases where junk science is replacing good science, I have to say that the one benefit is the local activity that it generates and the people who wake up, see what's going on, and maybe it starts to get them focused on making sure that in every curriculum that they're giving fair and decent treatment to the roles that minorities, that labor unions, that women played, because those same religious right characters that are against science also, frankly, are embarrassed about the realities of history. They want to look at good things. They want to look at how Christians did good things about ending slavery. They just don't want to admit that there were lots of people in America who were citing Genesis back as late as 1960 and saying that when God separated the light from the darkness, he meant segregation forever. So they will say anything, do anything, and the more sensitive we are to it, the better for not just science, but for a full-blooded curriculum that teaches critical thinking, that teaches respect for other students, all the things that we tend to get nervous about now.
Barry Lynn, it's always a pleasure, and I thank you so much for going into such detail with us.
Thank you. It's always fun being on the show.
That's a wrap this week. Our executive producer is Gordon Whiting, engineer Matt Fidler, assistant producer is Cindy Myers, Jill Fidler runs everything else around here. Our interns are Forrest Phillips, Kristen Stevens, Cecilia Castelli, and Megan Mina. Our theme is by Big Troubles, closing theme by David Gans. Visit our site for web extras from Gotta Laugh and more, indeepradio.com. Thanks for being here. I'm Angie Coiro. Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Coiro, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for 2 more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Coiro. We'll see you then. You're listening to WPWC, 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.